You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's with a positive message throughout.
Well, absolutely. Okay, so I have four kiddos. Holt is who we're talking about. That's my six-month-old. And he was born December 17th of 2025. I delivered him at 39 weeks. And this was my third C-section baby. So they always deliver at 39 weeks with repeat C-sections. So nothing alarming. Everything went really, really well throughout the pregnancy. And actually, me being 34, it was my best pregnancy, which is crazy. No crazy blood pressure, no swelling everywhere, just pregnant in the stomach, not my legs, not my ankles, nothing crazy. So really enjoyed being pregnant with him. And we went into it knowing he was our last too. So had him on December 17th. Everything went really, really good. No concerns. Just a regular, you know, the diapers, making sure he had enough pee diapers, making sure that he did poop, which he did. And then we go over to the 18th, and that's where the story gets a little weird and a little wonky. So they kept him overnight for a little bit so I could get some sleep because I figured they would discharge us on the next day, which they usually do. If you're repeat C-section and you feel good enough, they'll send you home. So we started feeding him, which I had already kind of gave them a little bit of notice ahead of time that our third child was lactose intolerant, which I thought maybe he would follow suit. So I was just like, hey, you know, if he starts spitting up, we probably should just go straight into soy milk. Take the lactose out of it if he starts spitting up, which then I kind of started eating my words. So he, around, I want to say 9:10:30 in the morning, started puking, which there's a huge difference between kind of just spitting up and vomiting. And at this point, he's vomiting. And I tell the nurse, and I'm like, hey, he is spitting up pretty much everything we're feeding him. So they bring down soy milk from the ward. And they're like, okay, let's try this. So we try that, same thing. He is continually puking. But mind you, I think they say turnaround time with a baby switching formula can take days for the old formula to completely leave the system. So they're telling me, not super concerned. Let's just move on about our day. Okay. So 2 o'clock rolls around. He's still puking. They release us from the hospital. They let us go home. And at this point, his stomach is hard, but not to the point where I'm like super concerned, but I'm still like, okay, his stomach's hard. This is a little weird. So I call back up to the pediatric unit that we had just left. And I'm like, hey, weird thing's happening. He's still puking and his stomach looks like I poured baby oil on it. And it looks like he has abs at the ripe age of 2 days old. Not normal. This is weird. So they go, we marked on his chart that his stomach was distended and we brought this to the pediatrician, but they just jotted it up as soy irritation because I had told them that my daughter was lactose intolerant. So not happy to hear that because no one brought that to our attention before we left the hospital. So red flag number one of very many. So we're going through the night. My mom had just left my house around 2:30 from watching my other kids. 6 o'clock, he's lethargic. He is not wanting to take breast milk. He is not wanting to take soy milk. He is completely does not want to eat at all. Totally disinterested. Still puking, actually waking up to dry heave and go right back to bed. Not normal baby behavior. So he's up long enough. So vomit, scream, fall asleep. So it's like, I want to say 6 o'clock. This is the second time I called the pediatric unit that we had just left. And I go, something is wrong. I don't know what to do. I've had 3 other children. None of them had ever done this. Even with learning about the lactose intolerance with my daughter, there was nothing that was even remotely close to this. So, first thing I'm going to say as a mom, always follow your gut. You're going to know something's wrong with your baby. Does not matter what a person in the medical field says. You know your baby better than anybody. Specifically, you carried your baby for 9 months. You know what's right. You know what's wrong. Always follow your gut. They then tell me on the phone at the hospital that I had just called, well, we can't do anything for him if it's serious, so you would need to take him to the university, which is an hour from us. So I immediately get on the phone with my mom. I'm like, something is wrong with him. I just know something's wrong. I can't tell you what's wrong because I've never dealt with this before, but something's wrong and I need you to get back over here. We hadn't even unpacked our bags yet. They were still in the car, thank God. So we get back in the car. We get to the university around 11:30 at night. And by the time we get there, our son is puking up bile, which looks like pond water. Literally just gobs of it. I mean, he is puking up bright green, mossy looking bile. We get in the doors. Thank God for, you know, how fast the hospital did work. Because we got through those doors, they're immediately putting IVs in him. They immediately put a sump pump down his throat to start sucking up the air and getting the green stuff out because they don't know why it's there. So they want to get it out for whatever reason. They're the number one. So the first things they start with is obviously X-ray, CT scan with dye, also ultrasound, which anybody knows that the X-ray they had noted, obviously, substantial amounts of gas is what they're seeing. They can't see anything else because it's just gas blocking pretty much the whole image, just gas. So then they're like, let's do a CT scan with dye, which we had to continually check overnight. So they were in and out, I believe, every 2 hours checking that CT to see where the dye is ending up, moving in his colon at that point, or stomach, rather more, because we didn't know where it was stopping at. So they come back in at, I want to say it's like 8 o'clock in the morning, and they're like, hey, we did the last check for the dye, and it is stopped halfway through his stomach. We are worried about blockage at this point. Okay. So we are finally admitted. We had to wait for a room in the NICU due to how many days old he was. So they had to make sure that they had a spot for us before they could even fully admit us. So they get us in a room, and this is 9:30 in the morning when they finally get us admitted and in a room. So actually, as we're leaving the emergency room department, there's a team of surgical doctors following us to our room. And I kind of had a weird feeling that I'm like, huh, this doesn't feel like just a run-in by chance. They follow us up the elevator. They gave us enough time to put our bags down. And they're like, your baby needs surgery, like immediately. We need to figure out why he is not getting the dye through his stomach and why there's a blockage. And it's funny. It's not funny, but trauma does a weird thing to you. So there's certain parts of the story. I think his heart kept doing weird things too. Like his heart rate was elevated with this as well. Because I remember the heart monitors going off. And it was only when he was getting really, really upset, but that's when he had all the gas on his stomach. So that was another thing that we were watching at that point. A super stressful situation. So we get up to the room, they go down, and I think they talk to the radiologist to for sure confirm they're doing surgery. They said, we'll be back in an hour to tell you if we are or aren't, but we're almost positive we have to do this. We're like, okay. So again, it's all the paperwork. It's all the worry. You're 2 days, on 2 days postpartum of C-section, we are completely overwhelmed. Because we don't know what's wrong with him. But so then they come back up. So this is around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. And they're like, yes, we're going to do surgery now. We're going to take him down with us. The exploratory surgery will probably take around 2 hours, give or take. So in the meantime, we're calling our family. We're telling them all the things that are happening. We really don't have answers. So then 2 hours goes by, and I'm just going to refer to him as Dr. G. Dr. G gives us a buzz on our little pager thing, letting us know they're coming back up to the room. So we go and we meet him in the room. He has a thick smile on his face, and he said, we're just going to call it sticky poop. It looks like it's just sticky poop. There's a whole bunch of the meconium that bunched up, and it was stuck there. But he did pass bowel before we even took him to the surgery. So all great things. He just had a lot of backup, but no blockage. All great news. So we're thinking, yay, it's over. It's over. But it did not turn out that way. So they immediately let us start feeding him after surgery because he was hungry at that point. So we fed him. And not even probably 2 hours in, he starts throwing up the bile again. So not good news. No more poop. Nothing else has happened in that aspect. So we're now on December 19th, and they are saying, okay, well, now we need to start looking at different things here because this is not just sticky poop. But I do want to note in this, and this was a big aha moment for me, is what they don't tell you is after exploratory surgery, they are giving your baby opioids to make your baby comfortable. But if anybody knows anything about opioids, it also causes constipation. So the sad part about this is you're fighting constipation, but the drug also causes constipation. So immediately, and again, I didn't think of this until after the fact of the times that we had put him under and what that looked like. And I wish it would have stuck in my brain sooner, but that is the one thing that has forever stuck and ingrained in my brain, I guess I would say, is when they had allowed us to feed him right after giving him a constipation drug. So, again, this is December 19th, and they had given him, I want to say it was,
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
I'm trying to think of what it was. I'll think of it. I'll think of it later. But it is an opioid, nonetheless. So, with that being said, moving on, it's the 19th, and they go, you know, there's other things we need to look at this point based off of his symptoms and what's going on. First thing being cystic fibrosis, which is done in the paneling, which I had already done at the other hospital. So they were awaiting that paneling, that it was going into a weekend. So probably not likely that we would get the paneling back to know about that until probably a couple days. So we had to wait on that. I want to say it took about 4 to 5 days to get the results of that, that it was not cystic fibrosis. So then we moved into the other thing of which they wanted to push more cystic fibrosis testing. We told them no, based on everything that Holt had already been through. We were like, no, we're stopping there. We want to know about the other thing, which was the Hirschsprung's disease. So the first thing that comes in the step with the Hirschsprung's disease was the first thing of the biopsy. So the biopsy was the first thing that was performed to see about that, which was done bedside. They come in. We actually got to watch the whole thing take place. But bedside, obviously, they go through the rectum. They say in the area that they test at the very end of the rectum, there is actually no feeling there. So he was actually happy when they were doing it because he was passing more poop. So he was kind of happy that that was happening. There was no signs of it actually being painful. So I do believe what they say about that. There's no nerve endings right where they do the first biopsies. So we did that first biopsy. They had told us that with them having it in their lab, it would only take a couple days. Also not accurate. We had to wait, I think it was 2 weeks to get those results back. Again, this is, I'm going to give them a little bit of benefit of the doubt simply because this was around Christmas. It was a weekend, a lot of things happening. So maybe those results come back at different places quicker, but in our circumstances, it did not. So that being said, so at the 19th, they decided they were not going to feed Holtz anymore. We were not going to feed him. So what that looked like was pure chaos, not good, very painful for everybody involved, mainly him, but also his parents, because that was very painful for a baby to not be able to eat. Now, what I will say is they give them like a sugar drip, which I think is kind of like a trick on the mind, but also keeping their blood sugar where it needs to. So basically they don't drop in their blood sugar is what it was explained to me. It's a more dense, I'm not going to say it's like a thin sugar water. It had to be through an IV, which they eventually did move his IV, which that's the thing that sucks with babies. Their IVs almost 95% of the time blow out. So they end up having to put one of those ports like either in their head or some other place to keep it so it's a consistent spot that doesn't blow out. So they ended up doing that with Holt. He went 4 days without eating. And they, on the third day, decided that they were going to give him a sham feeding, which I don't know if that's something you guys are familiar with in the UK. They fill the stomach with food and suck it right back out to almost trick the baby. It truly is a sham. It's a trick. But the baby's like, you guys are idiots. I know the difference. You scream the whole time. So 10 out of 10, do not recommend a sham feeding ever offer. Just very not good. So there was a lot of things that happened in the hospital, at our hospital particularly, that I was not super fond of. So Holt had a sump pump pretty much that whole time. So very hard to like hold a baby with the sump. Also, you know, he's hooked up to IVs. But the worst part is almost sometimes the bedside manner, which I'm sure anybody can say that somewhere, but there are just some people out there that are not very thoughtful that this is a really trying time for a parent and it's really hard. And I think they're almost oblivious to it because they see it so much. I won't say they see Hirschsprung so much, but they see a lot of babies in the NICU and, you know, but we were there. Surprisingly, there was not a lot of parents with their babies in the NICU when we were there, which to me was shocking, but I understand life happens. Not everybody can be there. But for us, there was no chance we were leaving. We were advocating. We were not leaving no matter what. One of us was going to be there at all times, if not a grandparent was there as well. So there was a lot of the teams would come in and they would meet every morning. So they would come in your room. This is a surgery team, pediatric team, as well as like, I think a nutritionist would come in as well. So it's kind of like a meeting of the minds every morning, but they're coming in and they're discussing this in front of you about your baby. So this is December. So a lot of things happened in the hospital to where Holt would kind of revert back. But it was December 24th. The night of the 23rd, I had finally just had to come apart. Because he was on day four at that point of no eating. And I'm like, I told the charge nurse the night of, I was like, I don't care what time it is when the surgery team gets here in the morning. I want them in my room immediately. Like, I don't care what time it is. 2 o'clock in the morning, come visit me, wake me up. I'm probably already up. So meantime, you know, the good thing of him not eating is I got to store a lot of breast milk waiting for him to finally be able to eat. But the downfall was on the 24th, the morning of the 24th, the surgery team had came in and they're like, kind of talking, and it sounds like maybe they're going to let him eat, but not really clarifying that. And I'm like, here's the thing. My baby's eating today. I don't care what that looks like. If I have to sneak him food illegally, he's my child. I'm feeding him. Like, he's hungry. The cries he's crying are not pain cries. They're hungry cries. Like, I'm a mom of three, like four now, and I know he's hungry. We're feeding him. Like, that's it. He's had an empty stomach this whole time. He's passing, you know, the wet diapers and all the things. So they're looking at me like, this woman's crazy. We're going to get her out of here. And they probably felt that way. And I felt that way as well. If that's what it takes, that's what it takes. So they come in, they finally pull the trigger and say, you know what? We're going to let him eat today. And I'm like, awesome. Love that. So I'm like, where are we at with our results? They're like, still nothing. Obviously, like I said, the CF was already ruled out. So it was the Hirschsprungs that we were waiting on. And again, this is Christmas Eve. And I'm like, here's the other thing. If this baby keeps everything down, we're leaving this hospital tomorrow. Because sitting here waiting on results does not do anything for anybody. I have other kids at home that need me just as much as he needs me. And I just need you to tell me where to from here to care for him at home. Because there's nothing you're doing here that I can't do at home. So they had told me, basically, if he kept all of his food down, which he did, and if he could keep like a substantial amount down, I think his goal was like 3 ounces, so many hours, which he surpassed with flying colors. No puking, nothing. So they say, if he keeps everything down, we will do that. So next morning, he surpassed it, flying colors. So then they start teaching you how to basically, is it like, I forget the term of what they call it. It's basically you give him an enema up the rectum. You're cleaning him out. So I'm doing that. So they tell me to do that, or we're actually, I said that wrong. I had to give him suppositories daily. So one time a day, suppositories. If he did not poo on the suppositories, that is when they had told me that I would need to clean him out. The other option if the suppository did not work. But the suppositories did work. But that's a whole different feat, giving a brand new baby suppositories, because they do not make infant size suppository. I mean, you're talking toddler suppositories is what you're having to give your baby, which is very hard. So they released us on the 25th. I believe we got home around 2 or 3 o'clock. So we had been there from the 18th until the 25th. So that was our first stint of it in the NICU. So I think our follow-up visit was 2 weeks after we were released. And we go in, we still did not have results from the biopsy at this point. So we go into our appointment, we're talking, and I'm like, okay, did we get them? Like, that's what I assumed the follow-up was for. That's when they were going to give us the diagnosis of what they were seeing. And they come back and they go, it was a false read. We actually already sent it off to the Mayo Clinic as well. And it came back as inconclusive. So we're going to have to do the test again. So we do it right then and there. I'm already irritated. And I know things happen. They were having issues with the gun that they actually take the sample with. I could tell they were struggling. Again, I don't know what I'm watching for because this is new to me as well. This is all learning curve at this point. So we do that sample, same exact procedure, bedside, happens right then and there. They're taking a sample of it. They're going to send it to their lab. 2 weeks goes by again. And so we're at a month now, and I'm happy to give him suppositories every day. And that being said, so 2 weeks goes by again, I get a call and they're like, there is none of the ganglion cells. We're not seeing any ganglion. Okay. Live ganglion, I should say. So, okay. And I'm like, what does that mean? They're like, that means that that is another indicator that this is probably Hirschsprung's. So let's move on to the next steps and what that looks like. So the next step is they want to do a CT enema of a CT dye enema, basically, to where it lights up the whole colon to see what the colon looks like. Because you're not going to see a perfect image without directly putting it in the rectum of that whole space there. So that's the next step. And then the other step is then going into and taking another rectal biopsy, except this one is more invasive. So they're trying to go as far up as they can without performing surgery, basically, in a nutshell, is what it sounds like to me. So we go in and we do the rectal CT dye first. That's the first step. We go in, we do that, and we see a picture of Holt's colon. And so a normal colon is all the same size. It's big, it's beautiful, it's perfect. It goes down to the rectum, it looks great. Holt's does not. So it looks perfect at a bird's eye view to start, but then it tapers off down. I want to say, I think they had said it was around 5 to 6 centimeters is when it starts thinning out down to the bottom of his rectum is what we're seeing. So again, different doctor, she's saying, yes, this looks conclusive with Hirschsprung's, but I'm not going to tell you that. We're going to move on to the next step. So that's one day. So it was back-to-back procedures. We had did that day. We go back the next day to the university again. And then that is when they had done his procedure. And I want to say we came home the same day from the procedure of them putting him out. But it was like a 2 to 3 hour collection of sample, I think, around that area. And then that came back relatively much quicker than the other biopsy, because I think they were just looking at it under the microscope for the ganglion at that point, and kind of in a more hurry-wise, I think, at this point. So I think we got those results back within 4 days. So Dr. G calls me and he's like, hey, no ganglion again. So here's what we're looking at. He's like, we're probably going to have to do surgery. But what the goal is, which there's, you can probably correct me on this because I'm kind of rusty on it. So there's the pull-through method and there is the small segment versus the big segment. So Holt's was considered at the point of time from the CT, based off what we were seeing, was considered small segment. But again, we don't know that until we're in there doing surgery, because they're going to test the ganglion while they're doing the surgery and getting clarification. So, and again, I don't know how they do it there, but what the textbook term they do here is, so they take the segment that's bad, that's not testing with the ganglion, and then they add another, I want to say he said 10 centimeters or 10 millimeters above that. So Holst was a total of 15 millimeters is what they had taken out. So I think it's 9 to 10 above the bad segment is what the textbook is telling them. And then they test again the ganglion around the donut. It's called the donut is what they call it. So they test more spots around the donut where the reconnect takes place. So that comes back later. But as long as they are seeing the ganglion cells, that is where they're going to do the donut connection at, above that area there. So that's what they did. It was a total of 15 millimeters. And they take that, stretch it down, reconnect it to the anus area, which I think they leave a very small portion at the anus as well where they do the reconnect. So they do that whole surgery. I want to say was around 6 hours. His actual surgery was 6 hours. So we come out of that, and the plan that they tell me at this point is Holt's goal is as soon as he poops, he can eat. That's what the saying is. So he poops, he can eat. But that's not necessarily true. So they tell you that because they don't want somebody to get upset. They stop. But each kid is their own. Holt poops on the second day after having surgery. Some kids can take up to 4 days after surgery to poop, but they will not give them food until usually that third or fourth day after the poop takes place. So again, they had allowed him to finally eat. Everything went really well. Unfortunately for me, while I was in the hospital with him, I ended up getting influenza. So I had to call somebody in to stay with my son because I'm like, I'm sick. I need to go home, get away from him as much as I don't want to. I don't want him getting this on top of what he's already got going on. So Holt did phenomenal until I left the hospital that night and they stopped kind of checking his diapers as much as they needed to. And what they don't prepare you for is the extreme diaper rash that comes with Hirschsprungs due to the acidic poop. And the acidic, well, just the skin breakdown is unreal. It's almost like your baby. I never really knew the term of diaper rash until I dealt with Hirschsprungs, because all the cases I dealt with before, that's nothing. That is nothing. That is a drop in the bucket. What I dealt with Hirschsprungs with my son is almost like a chemical burn to the skin. It if the poop sits on the skin for more than what feels like seconds, the skin is immediately breaking down. And that is extremely overwhelming. So I come home and I sleep that night and I come back to the hospital and they're calling me and they're like, hey, Hulk's bottoms really broke down. We're going to get a burn team in here. And I'm like, a burn team? Like, what are you talking about? So I get back up to the hospital around 4 o'clock the next evening. And I am just blown away because I'm like, how did it get this way? Who let the ball drop? Why weren't you checking him? Like, we're here for Hirschsprungs. Like, this is a huge deal. Like, I don't know how to fix this at this point. Like, I'm frantic because I don't know what to do to make him comfortable because he's just eating and pooping more and, you know, which is great. You never wish for more poop than what you do with Hirschsprungs. So it's like a double-edged sword. So I'm wanting him to poop, but then it's so bad that the acidic is so bad that I don't feel like I can control the diaper rash. So I think we were there for about 5 days and then we were released. And that's with extreme diaper rash. Like, they came in, the burn team came in, blessed the ladies the night of, because the when I got there at 4 o'clock that night, the burn team had already left. They left like stoma powder is what I was left with. And they're like, use stoma, which stoma did help some. I will say it did help some. But I was just, they did this treatment on his butt that is almost like, this is just to tell you how acidic it is, but they did this treatment on his butt and they almost say it's like a super glue kind of treatment. They put this ointment over his butt to shield his butt from the poop. It literally ate through the shield of the stuff they put on his butt. So it was almost pointless and it got worse because then it started getting hung on his diapers. So if anything, learn from my decisions and all my things, never do that treatment. I'll try to rethink of what it is and I can always message you what it is. I forget what it's called, but it was a treatment that they had layered this on his butt. Again, it almost gives him like a plastic type residue over his butt to save his butt from the rash. But again, the acidic poop ate through it. So then it's sticking to his diaper, which is making it 10 times worse. So finally, on the fifth day, They're like, are you sure you want us to send you home with his butt looking like that? And I'm like, his butt got like this while we were here. There's nothing you can do here for me that I can't do at home. So lots of learning, lots of forums. What I had read was 100% cotton diapers. If you're going to use diapers, 100% cotton, which is very almost hard to find in store, almost impossible. So Amazon is the goat for the cotton diapers. So we got that on subscription rolling in 100%. They're called Pura diapers here in the US. So that's what we use here. That has worked for him. The other thing that if you're in a pinch, like Millie Moon diapers also here work in the US that I've seen that, you know, give him a little bit of air, but like Pampers and stuff, no go. Huggies, no go. Not enough breathing stuff to keep it off of him. Also tried the cloth diapers. Wow, that's a lot of work. Kudos to the ladies that can do that all the time. I have tried and tried. And ever, if we're ever in a pinch, I do still use them because they're awesome. If you did not have other kids to tend to, or, you know, you could throw them in your laundry, they're super accessible and they're not like they used to be. So cloth diapers have come a long way. So we go through the surgery. I want to say the diaper rash was...
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
I mean, it was a hard week. Hard week, maybe 2 weeks of what felt like never-ending results. Like, you would think you would get ahead, and then he'd have a massive blowout that he's out in for 2 seconds. Because, I mean, and here's the other thing that I want to say that I've noticed with Hirschsprungs, the smell. It has a very distinct smell. It's not like normal baby poop. It's very strong, yet it sounds very weird saying this, but like a sweet, bad baby poop smell. I don't know. I've never smelled anything like it in my life, but I know the minute my son poops or has gas because it's a very strong scent. And, you know, I asked the doctor that and I'm like, is this a normal like thing for Hirschsprungs? And again, I don't think anybody really knows. He's like, it has a scent. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it has a very strong scent. Like, and he's like, that'll probably go away. It has not gone away. So that being said, I want to say it was a hard 2 weeks, which takes an emotional toll on you as a parent, because it's one, very overwhelming. And two, it's just this new world that you never knew existed, because I don't feel like Hirschsprungs is talked about enough, which you and I talked about at the beginning. So it's very overwhelming and you do feel very alone there for a very hot moment. But most of all, you just want your baby comfortable because he's already gone through so much that I'm just like, when does he get a break? Like, I mean, he's, you know, his butt is raw. And out of all of this, babies are so resilient. And I think that, you know, you don't realize that until after the fact and you're put in a situation like this, but they're so tough. And Holt is such a happy baby. Like, even pushing all that aside, like, he's just a happy-go-lucky baby that puts up with so much. So we are so over equivocally blessed in that aspect of, he's such a good baby and has such a great disposition, subsiding all the other things that go with it. So my son's overall diagnosis was small segment Hirschsprung's disease is what he was finally diagnosed with. That is why we did the surgery that we did. But the overall, the rash is your hardest beat when they're in diapers. I feel like it comes and it goes. And sometimes it's like, so Holt actually has some scarring already like on his anus from you know, certain spots of where the diaper rash got so bad that I would almost consider it a burn, honestly. But I don't feel like that's talked about in the hospital enough. They give you these little sample packets of like 40% zinc oxide. But what they don't take an account for is they give you this stuff and they only gave me like 20 little things of these like sample packs. Your baby is probably pooping a lot in a day. And I'm going through those sample packs, if not one or two a day. And then they don't give you more until you go back to the clinic. So as a mom, you have to start doing your research because no one's going to do it for you. And so there's always a way to figure things out. And that's the other thing I want to note in this is, as a mom, just give yourself some grace because you're doing the best you can with something you have no idea of how to maneuver, how to navigate. There is no perfect way to handle Hirschsprung's. There's not. You're going to have moments where you felt like you have gone 20 steps ahead to feel like you went 40 steps backwards. And there's nothing you're doing that's wrong. And there's nothing that you could do better than just love on your baby and do the best that you can and do research.
Absolutely. No, incredibly well said. But Ken, thank you so, so much for coming on. Okay. This has been fascinating to listen to. And I wish you, Holt, and the rest of your family all the very, very best for the future. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprung's Podcast or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprung's_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and we'll bring you another episode soon.